Hi, I'm Michael Strahan, and join me for Giant Steps to make it a Big Blue's first Super Bowl champion. An oral history from the Players Tribune, powered by digital media. Relive the moments that shaped the 1986 Giants as told by the men who contributed to that legendary defense, Bill Parcells.
It puts these guys together forever, and that's never going to change because they're each other's guys, and there's only a few of them.
Harry Carson, Pepper Johnson, Elvis Patterson, George Martin, Leonard Marshall, Carl Banks, and of course, LT Lawrence Taylor.
Nobody played with us. We was absolutely dominant. It was like men playing with boys. Nobody played with us. You can smell it. You can feel it. We could do anything. Anything.
Subscribe via iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts so that you can get Giant Steps to make it a Big Blue's first Super Bowl champion.
The MMQB presents the MMQB 10 Things Podcast, powered by digital media. Find your voice. And now, your hosts, Andy Benoit and Gary Gramley.
Hello and welcome to the MMQB 10 Things Podcast. I am Gary Gramling, here with Andy Benoit, and we are going to be talking all things Super Bowl 51 in this show. Previewing it, breaking it all down. But Andy, a little bit of breaking news here that we want to cover at the top, and that is the 49ers have themselves a GM, and it is John Lynch, which came out of, well, hopefully not for them. Hopefully they thought about this more than, you know, the last 24 hours or so, but that was completely out of nowhere.
As out of nowhere as I've ever seen, and I think and we're going to talk about this more Thursday, which is good because I need some time to just process this one. He was a good announcer. I didn't know he was interested in this. And I think the correlation people are going to make is Matt Millen out of the gates, which is irrelevant, but that's last time we saw a number two announcer from Fox or any network all of a sudden take a GM job that we didn't know was open to them. That was what happened. So that was who it was. Anyway, we'll get to John Lynch more Thursday. We'll hear him speak publicly first, too. This will be an interesting one.
Yeah. We'll have Lynch. Chris Ballard got hired out in Indy. They have a GM now. We'll see what that means for Chuck Pagano. But, yeah, 6 years for Lynch. That was. I mean, hey, they needed to invest in someone long-term because it's a long-term build. But, yeah, it was shocking. But like we said, we're going to talk Super Bowl 51 in this one. We're going to do a full breakdown. All 10 things in this topic. All 10 topics in this thing being the show, that's they're all going to be Super Bowl 51. That was a terrible segue.
Number one.
And Andy, we're going to start with topic number one. We're going to talk New England Patriots first. And this is the question that every Patriots fan has been asking. And that is, how do they stop Julio Jones?
And when we ask that, what we mean is how are they going to approach it? Because a lot of people say, how do you stop them? And then nobody actually talks about that. They just agree that Julio's a great player. And, hey, yeah, this segment's brought to you by Bud Light and yada, yada, yada. Mm-hmm. This is a hard one for me to get around. And Peter King called me twice in the last 2 days, and we talked at length about this. And Peter and I don't talk football strategy very much. And there are all kinds of scenarios. And I think you start with Malcolm Butler. Let's just start the discussion there.
Yeah.
He's New England's best cover corner. And do you put Butler on Jones? And Peter's point, by the way, is not a bad one. Because I told Peter, Malcolm Butler does not guard the biggest receiver. He always guards the smaller, quicker guy. Now, yeah, a lot of times those wind up being your number ones, your Odell Beckham, or like we saw last week, it was Antonio Brown. And so it looks like Butler's their number one corner. But they don't use him that way. When they play Denver, for example, he takes Emmanuel Sanders, and it's Logan Ryan who they put on Demaryius Thomas. Logan Ryan or Eric Rowe, whoever they feel best about that week, that's who takes the bigger guy. And Peter's point to that is that Logan Ryan's marginally bigger than Butler. It's a few inches and a few pounds. Yeah. I think that adds up, though, when it's wide receiver play. I think a few inches and a few pounds does matter, and so the size is a factor there. And then
Go
ahead.
He's also just more physical.
Right, that's what I was going to say. It's a type of size as well. It's the style of play. Butler's very physical, but it's a grabby, choppy physicality. It's not a strong man, lock and hold you type of physicality. So I think now we circle back, how are they going to stop Julio Jones? You're probably not going to stop him, but how are you going to try to do that? I think they're going to do what they've done with other big receivers. You put Logan Ryan on him. Now, if they don't like the matchup, maybe they go Eric Rowe on Julio Jones. And whoever it is going to have a safety over the top. And that's going to leave Butler free to play one-on-one against someone else, which they've also done that. They put Butler on the quicker guy one-on-one if he's not Antonio Brown. And they double the big guy with Logan Ryan and a safety over the top, probably McCourty.
Yeah, I guess the, you know, sort of the strange thing is when they run out two receivers, it's two big receivers. They can use Gabriel, Taylor Gabriel opposite Julio, but when they go two receivers, typically it's Julio and then it's Mohamed Sanu on the other side, and Sanu is, you know, he's certainly not as dynamic as Julio Jones, but he's, you know, a similarly big physical receiver.
And Sanu is 6'1". He's about 215 or so. So, yes, that is a bigger receiver. Butler goes at 5'11", 180. That's 35 pounds. So that's a huge discrepancy. And the interesting part of that, I think we would agree, if Gabriel's in the game, if they're in three receivers, Butler's going to take Gabriel. And they'll go the other two corners on Sanu. Probably Logan Ryan goes to Sanu, and Eric Rowe plays Jones outside. Mm-hmm. But what's complicating about all of this, including when they're not in three receivers, is Atlanta, with the way they play, they can still get any of these guys in the slot at any time. They don't have to go three receivers to get Mohamed Sanu in the slot. They'll put their tight end out wide or fullback Patrick DeMarco. We've talked about that last week. We had a mailbag question about it. They'll go with him out wide. So these receivers move around, and they don't really have a slot receiver, an X receiver, a Z receiver. They have different guys in different spots at all times. That's why they're here. That's hard to match up against.
Yeah, and look, you know, we've talked a lot about there's been a lot of talk about the weapons. The Falcons have so many weapons. I don't know if you necessarily look at this team and say, you know, after Julio Jones, there's anyone where you'd say like, whoa, you know, that's a you know, that's a weapon right there. That's a stacked receiving core. They're all so versatile, and they can all be used in different spots, and they can be used in different ways. And you know, the stat that's being thrown out there, the Falcons this year, when Julio Jones had 100 yards in a game, they went 4-4. When he had 60 yards, they went 7-5. When he had less than 40, and I will lump in the two games that he missed, which was at LA and the home win over the 49ers. They were 6-0 when they did not get 40 or more yards of receiving from Julio Jones in a game. So, you know, even though from an individual talent standpoint, I don't think you'd look at anyone else on this roster and say like, wow, there's a guy you really got to worry about. The system and the way they use these guys, it is what makes it such a diverse and dangerous offense.
This is an offense with three big time weapons: Julio Jones and both of the running backs, Tevin Coleman and Devontae Freeman. It's three big weapons who take turns playing in an extremely well designed offense that's quarterbacked by a savvy veteran. That's what the Atlanta Falcons are. And it's obviously the success when Julio's not catching the ball. That's a function of all the attention he draws. I think people know that. And with Bill Belichick, we always know he's going to take away your best weapon. That's his MO. But in this case, the history and the stats show, Atlanta is built in such a way when you take away their best weapon, they very well could become more dangerous because of the extent you have to go to take away that weapon. You're not just going to double Jones. You're going to commit dedicated double teams on Jones. Mm-hmm. So you can't disguise anything. So you get two players with their backs turned. I mean, there's a lot that goes in to doubling Julio Jones. You're not just rolling the coverage to him. You're truly double teaming him. And that's a lot to invest in one guy, and Atlanta makes you pay for that.
Yep, absolutely.
Number two.
Well, let's go on to topic two, and we're going to talk about those Atlanta backs right now and how the Patriots will try and neutralize them. And we'll start with the passing game. This is what I'm pretty interested in. You know, we just mentioned if you're gonna bracket Julio Jones, you're probably gonna use Devin McCourty, which leaves Patrick Chung as the guy who you'd presumably use to cover Freeman and Coleman coming out of the backfield. Is that right, Andy?
That's what I'm proposing. Now, I think a lot of people would assume Kyle Van Noy might be a guy that would do that, and they've used him like that before. But this is one of the rare teams where their running back is not just a better receiver than their tight end, and this might be the only team where this is true. We'd have to look across the league. I guess it's true in Pittsburgh as well. But the running back's a markedly better receiver than the tight end. He's their best, second best weapon. The running back might be a better receiver than their slot receiver even. And the interesting thing with Freeman and what makes him so unique is that he can be a receiver anywhere in the formation, so out wide or in the slot, but anywhere in the formation also means out of the backfield. Mm-hmm. And if you factor that in, and if you're playing a lot of man coverage, and I think that's what you have to play against Atlanta. I think they're too well constructed to play zone against, because zones, you can manipulate those easier than you can manipulate man-to-man. So I think you play man-to-man. They just carved up Green Bay's man-to-man, but New England's much more talented than Green Bay. So I think you play man-to-man. Then the question is, who takes Freeman in man coverage if he's in the backfield? And Chung remains a simple solution to that. He's one of the few safeties in the NFL who can play the slot, play linebacker in coverage. Chung can give them that dimension. And they'll already be in big nickel, I'm guessing. So if Atlanta has two tight ends or two running backs on the field, I would expect New England will have two corners and three safeties, with Chung being that third safety. I think he's the X factor in this whole game, Gary, is what Patrick Chung can do. Someone has to match up to those running backs.
Yeah, you know, we talked about it a little bit on the Thursday show. Chung did not play well in the AFC title game, and that was when he was matched up on Jesse James, and Jesse James is not the receiving threat that Devontae Freeman / Tevin Coleman is.
Correct. I agree with all that. And in fact, it got to where Pittsburgh was isolating the matchup and going after Chung. Now, the difference is that with a tight end, you can isolate him on the weak side and put him in space. And that's what Pittsburgh did. They put all three receivers to one side of the field. They put the tight end up on this line of scrimmage in his usual spot, alone on the other side. So when you do that, you create a lot of field, because the defender on that tight end has to handle the middle of the field where the tight end usually plays, but also everything to the boundary, to the sideline, when he's all by himself over there. You can't do that with the running back. You'd have to go to a 4x1 formation. It's not going to work. You're not going to see it with a running back unless they're willing to. The only way you might see it is if they have Coleman and Freeman on the field together, which they've done, but not a whole lot. That's not a foundation for how they play in Atlanta. Now, an extra week to prepare, maybe it does become a foundation.
Yeah.
But the point is, yours is a great point. Jesse James had a good game against Chung, so Freeman would. But Jesse James has a different area of the field he can work based on formations. Mm-hmm. Chung will have more help around him, or more, not help, but more bodies around him when he's taking on, if he's taking on Freeman. We don't know that he'll do that, but that's what we think he'll do.
How do the Patriots match up with this outside zone run game? Because we had talked, the Packers did all right against it both times they met the Falcons. Can this New England front have the same kind of success?
They've been dominant lately. Alan Branch and Malcolm Brown have been dominant. And Trey Flowers is a good technician, a movable piece along the front. So Patrick Chung, a lot of pressure's on him if he is indeed going to be the guy on these running backs, because he'll have to play linebacker against the run, essentially. But lately, Gary, teams haven't been getting to New England's linebackers, because nobody right now is moving Alan Branch or Malcolm Brown. And zone, it's a little more finesse-oriented. It's not about trying to displace the defensive linemen, not north and south anyway. So maybe their strength becomes neutralized. Typically, penetration along the defensive line is what kills an outside zone running play versus just having a big man stand there and clog the gap. That doesn't kill outside zone the same way. So Branch and Malcolm Brown, they don't match up quite as well stylistically. They're gap cloggers. Having said that, they're great gap cloggers, and great gap cloggers are always a problem in your run defense. So I would expect, my guess is this will be the type of game where Atlanta maybe runs the ball 16 to 18 times and gets about 80 yards out of it. I think they'll run the ball to stay on schedule at times, but I don't see this game coming down to them running the ball and winning it that way.
Yeah, yeah.
Number three.
Topic number three here. Let's talk Tom Brady. He is Tom Brady. He is very good at football. He is very good in the postseason. He was not particularly good in the Houston win. He was very good in the Pittsburgh win. Andy, have you seen anything from Tom Brady that would lead you to believe he will be anything but, well, Tom Brady in this game?
No, not I haven't. And he just killed a Steelers defense that's very young, it's fast, and it plays a lot of zone coverage. And that's what he's facing this week in Atlanta. A little bit of a different structure. They do more pure 4-3 alignments rather than some tilted 3-4 stuff that Pittsburgh will do. But Atlanta, at their core, they're a young, fast zone defense. And the same kind of zone, too. Both of them, Atlanta and Pittsburgh, both play cover 3. So Tom Brady should be licking his chops for this game. And Atlanta should be thinking, we're going to go more man coverage against Tom Brady. Because just like Atlanta's offense right now is too hot to play zone against, I think you don't want to be passive. And zone is kind of a passive coverage. Brady's too hot to play zone against. I don't think you do that. Brady right now is playing as well as he's ever played in his career, and we're talking about at least the most accomplished, if not the best, quarterback career in NFL history.
Yeah. No, I have nothing to add to that. Tom Brady's really good.
You don't disagree
with
the.
He's getting really good on
Sunday. You don't disagree with the assessment of where Brady is in history. You're a little older than I am, so you've seen more QBs, not by much, but you got half a generation on me.
I am. He's no slinging Sammy Ball. No, Tom Brady is I grew up with Montana, and you know, Montana's a fantastic player. I think Brady's the best of all time. I think considering the era he is playing in, the salary cap era, I think he's the best of all time. All the different variations of this offense that have come through during his career, and sort of the fact that, you know, outside of those maybe outside of the, like, Randy Moss, Wes Welker year, I don't think you'd ever look at this offense and say, like, wow, that's just, you know, that's a guy benefiting from overwhelming talent. He's won with really good talent around him. He's won with kind of average talent around him. He's just, yeah, he's always produced.
And keep in mind, with Brady, just advancing the barroom discussion that we had the rest of our lives to do, so we're not going to get into
yes.
Tom Brady much further here on Is He the Best of All Time, but his best season, and probably the best season in NFL history, and it doesn't get remembered this way because of how it ended, but it was that 07 season where they went undefeated for their first 18 games. So Brady could very well, after this Sunday, have 5 rings, plus none of them will have been his best NFL season.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Number four.
Well, let's go into topic number four, and let's imagine a world where, do the Patriots even consider maybe taking the air out of the ball a little bit, considering the Falcons' offense is on the other side of the field? And the other thing I was going to say, back when the Falcons lost in Philadelphia, this was in Week 10.
Yes.
Philly ran up 208 yards on them, and just, you know, they kept Matt Ryan off the field. Matt Ryan also didn't play well that game. The Eagles defense played very well. But, the Patriots can do this. They can go with, they can run out LeGarrette Blount and run him behind James Devlin, and they can do the power running thing.
And Gary, you're the first person I've heard that has suggested this, and I honestly hadn't thought a lot about it very closely. I kind of like the idea. And I like the idea of keeping Atlanta's offense off the field. They only ran 50 plays in that game against Philadelphia. I remember it because it was a joy to watch on film. I got through the film like an hour and a half. It was a short side of the ball film. So keeping them off the field, there's something to be said for that. The way Philadelphia did it was with a big variety of running plays. They had a lot of gap scheme runs, pull blocker stuff, and also just downhill north-south runs with double teams inside. And they did outside zone. New England's ground game is not quite that expansive. It's not a limited ground game, but it's not as expansive as Philadelphia's was that afternoon. But if they do run the ball, I think it will be with Blount. I think Devlin will be on the field. It'll be a factor. And I think they'll give it a shot because Atlanta's not big at middle linebacker. Deion Jones is little. And if you can get a body on him, and James Devlin as a lead blocker between the tackles would be that body, you're going to gain 8 yards if you can do that. Jones has to be kept clean. So whether New England runs the ball a lot, and if they do, I think it's between the tackles, especially if you got Bill Belichick saying this is the fastest defense we've seen. You don't run east and west against a fast defense. You'll go right down their throat. I think they do that. It's a matter of whether they feel they can get those defensive tackles blocked. Grady Jarrett, Tyson Jackson, when he rotates in there, Courtney Upshaw's been playing more, Jonathan Babineau, and Rashid Hageman's the other one. He plays in sub-packages more, but those are the guys. And as I list those guys and think about them, Jarrett's the only one that gives you pause, and he's been better against zone blocking than man blocking. We said a second ago, penetration kills outside zone running. Jarrett's been a good outside zone penetrator, but if you're double teaming him, you're going right up the gut against him. Maybe it's a different story. I like your idea, Gary. I like the idea of like Garrett Blunt getting 18 carries or something like that in this game.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's the old, sort of game theory type of thing. Do what they're not expecting you to do. You wrote a great piece off of Super Bowl 50 last year when you were out in Santa Clara about essentially the Broncos defense, where they were in the locker room literally laughing about the fact that, the Brandon Marshall quote was, "They did everything we saw on film. That's the crazy thing. Nothing new." So, you have 2 weeks to prepare. Maybe you do something a little unexpected. Now, of course, the Patriots are the favorites, so they're probably not. And when you have Tom Brady on your team, you don't have to think about it that hard. But, it's something to consider.
Yeah, and when you have Tom Brady on your team, and this is the difference with Tom Brady and Cam Newton, who's a much younger quarterback and was pretty much still developing, at least in star terms at this time last year, you can do everything. Because we just talked about Brady's not only done everything, he's won Super Bowls in every kind of offense you can imagine. So they do have the chance to do that. We've seen Belichick do that before, especially with the extra week of preparation. And that is one area, if that's how the game will go, if these teams are going to wrinkle it up a lot. Everyone's going to wrinkle it a little bit. It's how you play football. But if they wrinkle it a lot and even change parts of who they are, that's advantage New England, because Atlanta, hasn't been here before, which I think gets way overrated, but let's call that A. And then more importantly, B, they're much younger. Atlanta's very young defensively, and I don't think, if I'm Dan Quinn, I'm hesitant to change up my defense schematically for the biggest game of the year if I've got 3 rookies out there plus a bunch of other young guys. So if it's about change up, New England has the edge. It's a matter of whether they want to do that or not.
Yep. Well, we are going to switch over to the Falcons in just a moment, but a couple of reminders before we do. We do a show on Thursdays. I can't believe you didn't know that if you didn't know that. But we do the Look Ahead show on Thursday. We are going to talk more Super Bowl 51. We're also gonna do the John Lynch hiring, the Chris Ballard hiring, a little bit on Greg Minuski maybe, and anything else that might break over the course of the week here. And, if anyone pulls a Barrett Robbins type of deal, we will talk about that too. But we don't expect that to happen. Do you remember Barrett Robbins? Were you old enough for Barrett Robbins?
Well, of course I was. Yeah, that was 2002. I was a sophomore in high school. And Adam True, that was the guy who replaced Barrett Robbins.
Yeah.
And it's from what I didn't break down offensive line back then, but from what I understood, that was not a big downgrade. That was not the event that people made it out to be.
Yeah.
And Barrett Robbins, his life was never the same. But for how it impacted the game, that's not what decided the game.
And yeah, not to open up old wounds for Falcons fans, but you had Eugene Robinson as well back in, I don't remember the Super Bowl numbers anymore, but back when they lost to the Broncos. That was,
by the way, your thing about not remembering the numbers, that's because they use these stupid Roman numerals. I go over this every year, except last year. Actually, I did it more last year because they got away from the Roman numerals for number 50. They didn't want the L representing the Super Bowl, and they need to do that again. It needs to be just 51, the number. I don't know why we use – you can use the numerals as a logo, but like – magazines like Sports Illustrated, for example, that uses it as the way they write it out. That's the style guide. That's bleeping stupid.
I like the Roman numerals. And
well,
I
you
think
couldn't
really
even remember one. You just forgot the Super Bowl you were talking about. You don't remember what the 1999 Super Bowl year was.
I think it really hammers home the importance of my third grade education when we did the Roman numerals unit.
There's a
and
reason.
I like to do them. I like to do the Roman numerals before I've seen what they are each year, so I can be like, but it's really only fun when you get out to like 8 or 9 as the second numeral. But
There's a reason the whole thing went extinct. They're not around anymore. That's the
Roman numeral fan.
Let's write all of our articles in cuneiform this week. Let's carve them onto tablets. That worked so well back then.
Oh man. Now this is an off-season discussion. We'll have to do that. And by the way, send your questions. We'll answer plenty of questions, Super Bowl or otherwise, on the mailbag, and that runs on Thursdays. So go ahead and do that. But let's get back to this show.
Number one.
And we are on topic five. We are talking Falcons now. Falcons perspective. Topic five. I mean, look, the Falcons, very young up the middle, but there's no, between a... Deion Jones and Keanu Neal, fast but young, but no Rob Gronkowski in this game. So you figure that's one less weapon for the Patriots to exploit these young guys with.
Well, but that's been they've had that one less weapon for a couple of months now. Martellus Bennett plays tight end. He's still a top 10 tight end. Probably 8 to 10 is where he would rank in the league. And Keanu Neal will be the guy who guards him. That's who's guarded tight ends all season long. I think the interesting matchup, though, Gary, you mentioned Deion Jones, so let's take it one step out. We know Keanu Neal's guarding Bennett. Go out a step. Who's split out wide in the empty formation, and it's running back. My guess is it'll be James White because he's a more diverse running back as a receiver than Deion Lewis. Lewis is great, though. Could be Lewis as well. Mm-hmm. But Deion Jones is the guy who guards running backs in Atlanta's scheme. And then Devondre Campbell's always the free defender, depending on what they're playing. And so Deion Jones versus James White becomes a critical matchup in this Super Bowl.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. If you're a Falcons fan, Andy, are you freaking out about the fact that you have two rookies up the middle against a Tom Brady-led offense?
We've had those two rookies up the middle against an Aaron Rodgers-led offense, and you had him against, not that he's the same veteran, but you played Jameis Winston this season, you played Drew Brees, Cam Newton, you've played good quarterbacks with those rookies up the middle. I would have been freaking out early in the season, but if those rookies had played the way they did early in the season, then they wouldn't be playing in this Super Bowl here. Those guys have gotten better is what we're getting at. And we've talked about how they've gotten better in their zone coverage awareness. They play faster. When you get more comfortable mentally, that's when you play faster. So we're starting to see that Atlanta's not as fast early in the season as they are now because now all their guys feel better with what they're doing. So I don't think you even treat these rookies as rookies. Maybe they will feel some extra jitters early in the Super Bowl, but you know what? Maybe they won't. Remember, sometimes you hear guys, they're so young that they assume they'll be back in this game and they don't realize how big it is. So it very well could be the veteran guys. Martellus Bennett, who's, and is 32 years old, played 10 years or so. This, I believe, is his first Super Bowl. He could feel the butterflies more. He knows he might not have another shot at this. So I don't get into that rookie stuff as much as some people like to do.
All right. Fair enough, Andy.
Number six.
Let's go on to topic six. And let's talk Julian Edelman, and I want to start this by turning back the clock a little bit, back to Super Bowl 49. This was Dan Quinn was running the Seahawks defense. Seahawks had a pretty good beat on this Patriots offense until they had lost Cliff Averill later in the game, but when Jeremy Lane basically broke every body part on that tackle and the interception. That opened up a huge weakness to exploit when they had Thurl Simon trying to cover Julian Edelman out of the slot, and they kept on using that whip route over and over again, and that kind of was unstoppable that game. The Falcons are, you know, they've been banged up in the secondary. No Desmond Trufant. The guys who have filled in have been good, but I feel like they haven't seen anyone like Julian Edelman, certainly in the postseason so far.
They probably haven't. And there aren't, for one, there's only like, what, three or four guys in the whole NFL like Julian Edelman. He's a unique talent. He's a great slot receiver, and he's more than just a slot receiver, too. Brian Poole's been their slot guy. I think that's who covers him. What makes this whole thing, the X factor in this whole matchup, though, we haven't really talked about how is Atlanta going to use their man-to-man coverages, because you don't just play man-to-man, you play different forms of man-to-man. If you're a blitzing team, then you pretty much just play man-to-man. You have a deep safety as an insurance policy, and here we go. Atlanta's not a big blitzing team, and they did it more against Green Bay than I thought they would, but that's Aaron Rodgers, who's a totally different style of quarterback than Tom Brady. I don't think they'll blitz Tom Brady. So what do you do with your non-blitzing defenders and man coverage, your free defenders? And something that's called man-free lurk, which is man-to-man with one deep safety in the middle deep and then one extra defender in the shallow parts of the field right in the middle, that's man-free lurk. That extra defender's a lurker. That's a good way to handle Julian Edelman. That lurker becomes a double-teamer on any crossing patterns. He helps minimize the run after the catch. And if you take away the middle of the field, which is what Quinn has aimed to do in other series, he did it against Denver most of all a few years ago, before he faced Brady, but that was the best example. He likes to rush three and drop eight and take away the middle of the field, especially against teams that spread out into empty formations, because he knows he doesn't have to worry about the running game. So he's comfortable dropping defensive linemen or linebackers back in those middle areas. But if you take the middle of the field away, that's a great way to disrupt New England's run after catch game too, because now Brady's throwing outside and the sideline becomes a defender. There's less space, so you can minimize the run after catches. So when we talk about what goes on with Julian Edelman, I think it's Brian Poole who guards him, and Poole's a better player than Thurald Simon, of course, especially inside. But I also think it's Devondre Campbell who's likely to be the lurker, maybe Keanu Neal, depending on who's in the game. Mm-hmm. Those are the guys that guard Edelman, though. You can double-team Edelman without dedicating a double on him.
Yeah. Yeah, so what, would you just sort of leave Ricardo Allen out there in center field at that point?
Yeah, that's where I would play Ricardo Allen, and that's where he's played for much of the season.
All right. No, that's interesting, and certainly this is a I feel like this is going to be a much bigger challenge for the secondary than the Packers were, and than the Seahawks were, and you know we've sort of been waiting to see if it falls apart without Desmond Trufant, and I feel like this is sort of the first time you'll really get a big time challenge for him.
What's interesting, I agree with that, and it's not so much about the personnel, it's the way they use the personnel in New England. Those first two teams you mentioned, Green Bay and Seattle, those are quarterbacks who extend the play and spread out the field, and it becomes sandlot, even if it's a structured sandlot. And when you play that way, it seems to me like a defense's speed would become more of a factor, because now we're running around, we're covering the whole field. New England, where it's a quarterback who's going to get the ball out quickly, that negates your speed a little bit. You're not going to be a fast guy the first 0.5 seconds of the snap, which is very well when Brady could make his decision. So it's a different type of challenge altogether. It's more of a pre-snap game for Atlanta this time than a post-snap game, and that's not ideal if you've got young guys and a quarterback who's entering his seventh Super Bowl in, what, his 17th season, something like that?
Yeah.
Number seven.
Yeah, well, let's go on to topic seven, and we'll talk a little bit about what Tom Brady will be facing in this pass rush. You know, when teams have knocked Brady off his game, it's been the pass rush. That's not really a secret or a surprise. That's pretty much every quarterback in football. You know, the Falcons' box score stats were big this year. They had Vic Beasley, who is the leading sack getter in the NFL this season. But, you know, Beasley he picked up a lot of those sacks along on those sort of looping, stunts and that sort of thing. Is that even an option against Brady, considering how fast the ball comes out?
There's two ways to look at that. One is, no, it's not an option because the ball's out so quickly, and a stunt, even if it's being executed by Vic Beasley, who's faster on stunts than almost anyone, maybe anyone in the NFL, it's not going to arrive on time still. So, no, it's not an option. But the other thing to consider is if – and teams look at their blitzes this way, and no one talks about it. This was explained to me by Jason Tarver, who was the Raiders' D coordinator at the time. This was a few years ago. They'll build their pass rushes in a way that loops and stunts guys around into the gaps that the quarterback throws the ball out of. So if Brady's throwing the ball through the B gap a lot, which would be Edelman on those option routes, kind of near the outside to inside linebacker area and that little void there, then if you stunt a guy into that gap, you potentially get a defender looping around in the face of the quarterback. So Brady has to now throw through that defender. So maybe Atlanta views it that way. Hey, we'll stunt up the middle, and that'll at least we're not going to get home with the sack, but that will put bodies directly in the passing lane that Brady's trying to exploit. I mean, it's. I just thought of that. I don't know if that's how they would view it or not. My inclination is to think don't stunt. Drop the guys back, because the last team that have that's really kicked Brady's butt was the Broncos in the AFC Championship game. And in that game, they sent three men after the quarterback and dropped eight into coverage. I think they did that 15 times, something like that. They'd only done it about five times all season long. It was something new they did. And when they did that, Brady was forced to hold the ball, and then his one-on-one blockers, which there aren't a lot of them in a three-man rush, but somebody still gets caught one-on-one outside. Those guys didn't hold up, and Brady took sacks that way. So they sacked him by rushing fewer guys.
Yeah. Yeah, and, well, look, we said a week and a half ago in the lead-up to the Packers-Falcons game, you know, well, nobody really blitzes Aaron Rodgers. It's just not worth it. You're just, you know, you're basically setting yourself up for trouble because he's gonna get away from it and extend the play. And obviously, Brady's a different type of quarterback, but I don't know, do you give any sort of credence to that line of thought, just sort of the fact that, you know, teams don't blitz Tom Brady, so maybe we're the team that does it.
Well, I give credence to the thought along the lines of what's behind the thought, the intention of the thought. And the idea with blitzing Rodgers is we're going to make him play on our schedule, not on his schedule. But if you think about the type of quarterback Rodgers is, his schedule is to hold the ball and extend the play. So you blitz him to make him get rid of the ball, and now he's playing on your schedule that way. Brady's schedule is the total opposite. His schedule is to get rid of the ball. So if you want to make him play off of schedule, which is a great way to face any QB, then you would want to make him hold the ball, and that gets back to dropping extra guys into coverage. The other team that did this was not this season, but it was the year before, again last year, and it was the last time Brady, I believe, lost at home. I'd have to double-check that. But Philadelphia, remember that game they went in, and they had all the special teams touchdowns and return touchdowns? That's a great way to beat Brady as well, score on punts and interception returns. But let's say you're not doing that. The other thing Philadelphia did a lot was rush three and drop eight, and New England's passing game had no rhythm whatsoever that day. Now, they were without a lot of guys. Everybody was hurt that game. But conceptually, the idea, if you want to get Brady off of schedule, then you rush three and drop eight, because Brady is not a hold-the-ball quarterback. The later it gets in the down, the less comfortable he is. Even though he's been tremendous here this season, you have to look at the whole body of his work and his style of play. I think you try to make Brady hold the ball.
Number eight.
Well, we talked plenty about Falcons defense right here, but let's go on to topic eight, and that is Matt Ryan, who he seems like an afterthought. By the time you hear the show, he might have been named NFL MVP, and he's kind of like the B story to this game somehow. But you know, I guess between Tom Brady and all the extracurricular crap that went on the past offseason, Matt Ryan becomes the forgotten man here. But obviously his first Super Bowl can be a little bit different for guys. But Ryan, you know, quite unfairly coming into this postseason, it was, well, can Matt Ryan win in the postseason? And, you know, it wasn't really a question back then, but it's certainly not a question now. Going up against Belichick, extra week to prepare. You know, Kyle Shanahan has been better than any offensive coordinator in football this year. Is there any reason to think that Matt Ryan won't be able to put up points in this game?
There's no indication of that. Could they have a bad day? Of course. And could New England outplay them? Yeah, that could happen as well. But just going off of what we've seen, which is all we can analyze with, there's no indication that's going to happen. And I think we forget about Matt Ryan because he's kind of like the conductor of the orchestra in Atlanta, and it's such an incredible symphony that they have put together there. We forget about him, but he kind of just runs the show that's put together and executed by those around him, which I don't know if that's fair, but that's the assessment. And I think he'd take that. It's earned him MVP this season. He's going to win the MVP award.
Yep.
Number nine.
Well, let's go on. We have a topic number nine here. We're going to cover some miscellany before we check out for this show. The officiating. We have who is it? It's Carl Sheffers and his all-star crew. It's like the Pro Bowl for officials. I don't know why they continue to do that, because everyone always complains about it, but they do continue to do it that way. But yeah, you know, we've talked. You have two secondaries that are not as good as the passing games they will be going up against, particularly talking about the cornerbacks here. You know, officials in a big game, they can be reluctant to throw a lot of flags. You know, it sort of hurts the entertainment of the product. Lady Gaga or not, no one is going to be happy watching a game with 25 flags thrown or something like that. I mean, does that play more into the Patriots' favor or the Falcons' favor in your mind, Andy?
The Patriots' favor, because as I wrote an extra point last week, I think if they don't get, I think they need to get four or five defensive foul flags in this game, and that'll be a good indication that they're playing the way I think they need to play, which is to say, they need to just mug the Atlanta Falcons receivers. Make the referees put the onus on them to make the calls. Because as good as New England is on defense, they have a lot of really solid guys. They don't have really any stars, but they're solid at every position just about. Those guys aren't as good as Julio Jones. They're probably not as good as Mohamed Sanu in certain ways, and they're not as good as the opportunities that the system will create for the ancillary weapons in Atlanta. Throw off the timing. Make the referees have to make tough decisions, be very physical with them, and naturally you're going to get a few flags that way. But Atlanta's going to move the ball up and down the field anyway. Five-yard penalty, automatic first down, that's not the worst thing against them. The worst thing against them is they gain 35 yards on you. And if you're getting those five-yard penalties, you don't strive for the penalty, but if you're playing the type of football that might engender some of those five-yard penalties, whether the flag's coming out or not, you're not getting beat for 35 yards that way. And then the game becomes more about who wins in the red zone. And New England's been Atlanta has not been good in the red zone overall. They've been better lately. But New England's been very good in the red zone all season long. They're a bend but don't break defense.
Number 10.
Well, let's go on to topic 10, because I do the segues around here, Andy. And we're going to talk about the sevens or threes. It's performance in the red zone here. You know, the X factor in a lot of game, it turns into, you know, oh, who's going to turn it over? Who's going to make the big mistake? These are two offenses that don't make mistakes. Falcons had 11 turnovers in 18 games this year. That's the fewest in football. Patriots had 14, and they would have been second fewest in the regular season. The Bills did not make the playoffs. They had 12. So, yeah, these are two teams that just don't turn it over. The red zone is where it can you know, that's where this game might be decided here. Like you mentioned, Patriots were eighth in red zone efficiency this year. The Falcons were ninth. I should say that's not efficiency, that's touchdown percentage. A little bit different than efficiency.
Which I think is how they should grade efficiency,
yeah.
Because the field goal's kind of it's not a gimme, but it's a 37-yard field goal.
Yeah, right.
You don't go to the red zone and say, glad we got the field goal.
Yep. But I do want to mention, I was surprised to see this, red zone defense, Patriots were eighth, they're a bend but don't break defense. The Falcons were last. Falcons allowed touchdowns on 72.7% of opponent red zone trips, and that seems like it would be problematic.
And I don't know what to make of that, to be honest with you. I know, first of all, with New England, they do become a little more schematically diverse once you get to the red zone, and mainly the far red zone. So we're talking the 20-yard line, call it the 15 to 25 yard line. I know that's not purely red zone, but that area of the field, that's where they become. They might blitz you. They'll give you something you haven't seen yet. So just be on high alert for that. And you can, by the way, fool Matt Ryan with that at times. He used to get fooled with it once or twice a game, and he'd throw those interceptions, and we'd wonder, hey, what? How can a smart QB do this so regularly? He hasn't done that anymore, and so I don't think that's a big concern, but it's something to keep in mind. But as far as Atlanta's side and how their red zone defense isn't any good, it's funny because I hear all the time from coaches, on the record, off the record, whenever you're just talking football, they emphasize how important it is to win in the red area and using the sideline and the back end zone line as your extra defenders and taking advantage of the smaller space and winning in the red, being a man, winning in the red zone. But and it's been a few years since I've looked, but when you generally check out the stats, they don't correlate to wins and losses a lot. Now, great examples, we're talking about Atlanta, the league's worst red zone defense, and here they are in the Super Bowl because they have maybe the league's most improved defense, period. So yep. I don't know what to make of red zone stats because the times that I've looked and done studies, and maybe so I'd love, in fact, I would really encourage mailbag on this and let me know if I'm wrong or if I'm not seeing something because the times I've done studies, it doesn't correlate to winning and losing. Red zone stats are almost their own entity is how I've treated it. I'm not saying you don't win in the red zone. I don't know how to interpret the stats of it, though.
Well, like any stat, the more successful someone is, the more likely they have wins. I pulled up the goal-to-go stats here just out of curiosity. The Giants were the best goal-to-go defense this year, followed by the Steelers and the Patriots. Falcons, again, as you might imagine, since they were last in red zone overall, they are 28th. But, you know, the other teams down here, you had Buffalo, Detroit, the Rams, the Vikings were actually the worst in goal-to-go situations this year. But the other thing about red zone defense is, you know, if you're a defense that isn't very good, you give up a lot of drives that end up in the red zone. And, you know, if you are a little bit better defensively, like I'm looking at some of these numbers right here, the Vikings only faced 20 goal-to-go drives, whereas, the Falcons faced 32. So I don't know what to tell you, Andy. Maybe it was just season jitters.
It's just a lot of numbers here. And the Vikings are one of the best defenses in the NFL. And they're not in the playoffs because their offense was bad. Same with the Rams. So I don't know what to make of it. Again, we all agree it's important. You want to hold them to three instead of seven. But the numbers are somewhere along the lines, they're painting a very misleading picture. And I don't know where along the lines they are. And I guess I haven't gone to the trouble. You know what? This is Jeff Irwin. What's he even doing right now? Jeff Irwin could be on this for us. He could have found this information.
Right this moment, he should be looking up red zone stats and how they correlate to wins and losses.
Yeah, he is. You know, postseason, it gets easier for Jeff Irwin, and he doesn't have our player rankings to ruin like he did in the offseason if people paid attention to that. And he doesn't have as much to put together in the outlines because there's not so many games. So we have been victims of bad help this week. Jeff Irwin didn't get it done, and we need some red zone numbers from him.
Oh, boy.
Well, let's start by asking him. Let's start by asking him next time. We'll ask him.
I was going to say, why did you not read our minds and know we were going to talk about red zone stats? We love Jeff Irwin, no matter what Andy just said.
No, he's great. In fact, he put together, I feel bad now because I had a flight today, and he put together an Excel sheet of 32 tabs of each team's depth chart, color coding when everyone's contract expires so I could see who's will. Yeah, that took some time.
Yeah.
So I really regret what I just said, but, you know, that's here we are in the show, and we still don't have the red zone info. There's no denying that.
Nope. There you go. But, you know, as we just said, maybe it doesn't mean anything. Maybe points, I don't know. What's the meaning of any of this?
Well, tell the people how to contact us for questions for Thursday's show. And we have great listeners. Someone will give us some red zone information we can use for Thursday.
I will do that. You can do that too, Andy. But I'll do it right now because I usually do it. You can get us on Twitter. Andy_Benoit or GGrambling_SI. It's up to you to try and determine who is who right there. We are both on Facebook, and Facebook's great, especially for stuff like this, because you can write as long as you want on Facebook. You're not limited to, you know, sending a string of seven tweets if you want to do it that way. You can also write to talkback@themmqb.com, which also you get lots of space, but I don't check that inbox that much, and it's dependent on someone forwarding me those emails, so that's just the way it goes there. But let's go on to topic 11, and that is Pro Bowl. Andy, do you know who won? Do you know who won the Pro Bowl?
No, I don't. And this is the 10 Things podcast, and that's really not a thing.
The AFC won. The co-MVPs were Travis Kelce and Lorenzo Alexander. But the talking point on the game was Lorenzo Alexander kind of blew up Jimmy Graham a little bit. Didn't totally blow him up, but Jimmy Graham did not appreciate it. So there was there was an awkward moment there. It was not the Pro Bowl fun moment of the night.
Good. Well, and then Carl Sheffers is getting to do the Super Bowl, but it sounds like Travis Kelce got his revenge on Sheffers there. He showed him.
There you go.
Look who grabbed the headlines last. Well, I guess Sheffers will get him last. Hopefully he won't. Hopefully nobody notices Carl Sheffers.
Hopefully next Monday we're not talking about officiating on the show.
You know what I liked about the whole Kelce thing? I like that he ripped the ref. He was wrong, of course. He was way wrong. We could all see that. It was a holding foul on Eric Fisher. But then he doubled down on it a few days later, said, yeah, fine me. I'll accept the fine. He paid the fine, and then he apologized. That's exactly how you're supposed to do it right there. That's being a pro who gives a damn.
Yeah. I guess it was a nice moment. Nice-ish.
Well, I like he didn't retreat too early. He owned up to it. I wonder at what point he knew he was wrong. Surely it wasn't right after the game when he was saying the footlocker stuff about Sheffers.
So you give him points to sort of sticking to his guns to sort
I
of
like
you know.
That, yeah, I, because he's going to have one other chance. He doubles down, and then the fine comes. So he's going to get a chance to have it back in the news one more time. So it's going to be in the news three times. Once right after the game when he's making it news. Again, when he's asked about it in the little end of the season interview or however the media gets to him. And then again when he's fined. And in that little end of the season interview thing where the fine hadn't come yet, he doubled down again. He said, I stand by every word I said. I'll take the fine. Then he pays a fine and he apologizes. I think that's a gentlemanly way to stand up for your left tackle who got flagged for holding.
It's the circle of life.
Yes. And now watch that Carl Sheffers will be the ref that they get in week one, whoever Kansas City plays next year, I bet.
Yeah. I'd take that bet.
You'll take
what was the bet? I already forgot what bet we made last week. But we'll have to revisit the show.
Yeah, which, all right. Yeah, I don't know. Irwin could do that too. Irwin should
exactly
have the bet.
When he's looking up red zone stats. I'm calling it, Andy. I am ending the show because we are just rambling like two, I don't know, raving derelicts or something. Thank you to producer Matt Havio, working the late night again, and editor Chris Basil always makes us sound human for the most part. The guys at Digital Media really been great to us this season. Jeff Irwin, thank you very much for the research help and for making us sound smart, no matter what Andy Benoit might say. Again, we love you guys. Please send your questions for the Thursday mailbag. We will get to as many as we possibly can. Andy_Benoit, GGrambling_SI on Twitter. We're both on Facebook, very available there. And we can also get emails sent to us. You send them to talkback@themmqb.com. Remember to listen and subscribe to new and archived episodes of the MMQB Podcast with Albert Breer, the MMQB Podcast with Peter King, and this podcast, the MMQB 10 Thing Podcast, wherever you listen to podcasts, including the MMQB.com, SI.com, iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, and other podcast providers. We will see you guys on Thursday.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.